weightlessly. Can't be more than 20 soldiers coming over here. 30, maybe. And how many men do we have? 63 technicians and machine operators in factory, said Coctons. 19 are women, not counting you and the lady. Dan turned slightly toward Lucita. In the flat, shadowless lighting of the metal wall tunnel, she no longer looked like an elfin little waif. She was a woman, Dan realized, as brave and determined as any woman who chose to stand beside her man in the hour of mortal danger. Unsmiling, her dark eyes searching his, she seemed totally unafraid of whatever fate was approaching. And totally beautiful, desirable. A woman worth fighting for, worth risking everything for. We have laser-cutting tools, Coctons was saying. Maybe they are clumsy to handle, but they could slice a man in half like that. He snapped his fingers. And slice through the factory's walls while we're at it, Dan countered. We could get them when they come in airlock. Yeah, we could kill some Russian kids in soldier suits. They just send more of them up here. In the end, we'd get every one of us killed. They kill us all anyway, Coctons said. You think they let me go free? We're not going to fight them, Dan said firmly. But not with lasers or pistols. Not the way they expect. What do you mean? Without taking his eyes off Lucita, Dan told the Latvian, We'll try a strategy the Russians have used on invaders since the time of the Mongols. I don't know if it'll work, but it's the only chance we have. Willem Kvistegaard took a deep breath of clean alpine air as he stood at the top of the run. The wind had died down after blowing away the clouds. The sky sparkled freshly blue, and the snow beneath his skis felt good. Dry powder, in perfect, unspoiled condition. The dismal gray rain of Paris had turned to new snow here in Switzerland. Being chairman of the International Astronautical Council had its benefits, the best of them being that he got preferential treatment at his favorite ski resorts. Later in the day, this run would be filled with bureaucrats from other UN agencies who were taking the afternoon off, and clumsy tourists from Bulgaria and similar backwaters. But this morning, it was all his. He lowered his goggles over his eyes, took in the spectacular Swiss scenery once more, then pushed off and headed down the clean, empty slope. He felt the bite of the cold wind in his face and the exhilarating, half-frightening thrill of racing down the mountainside. This must be something like the feeling they get in zero gravity, he thought as he bent forward into the wind. Perhaps one day I will let them take me up to one of the space stations and see what it's like. They were waiting for him at the bottom of the slope. As he rushed along on the final leg of the run, he could see his responsibilities gathered down there. A long black limousine, several of his assistants standing by the car, looking as out of place here on the ski slopes, in their fur-trimmed overcoats and Homburgs, as he would look in the IAC offices in his stretch pants and windbreaker. He braked to a stop, in a swirl of powdery snow just a few meters from where they stood. What's the matter? He asked. What's happened? His chief secretary, a fellow Swede, tall, raw-boned, as blonde as a Norse god, crunched across the snow in his expensive Italian shoes. All hell's broken loose. The Soviets have seized Nueva Venezuela and apparently killed a dozen people. My God. They claim they were pirates, caught in the act. Of course. Why else would they do it? The Japanese government has asked for an immediate emergency meeting of the General Assembly. So has the United States. The Americans? A tendril of fear crawled up Kvistegaard's spine, a fear he had not felt for more than a decade. The Americans claimed that they had dismantled all their nuclear bombs. The Russians claimed that they could shoot down any missiles fired at them. But was it all true? Could there be a nuclear war now, after all these years of peace? There's more, the secretary said. We just received a protest from the government of Venezuela against the Soviet seizure of their space station. More protests have come in from several other third-world nations. Kvistegaard felt his hands trembling inside their gloves. And the Chinese? What do they say? Nothing, as yet. He leaned on his ski poles and felt his heart racing, pounding inside his chest. It is all Dan Randolph's fault, Kvistegaard told himself. Everything was going along peacefully, until the damned American began to rock the boat. I hope the Russians find him and hang him from the Kremlin walls. But to his secretary, he said, Help me get these damned skis off. We have 1,000 things to do, and only a few hours in which to do them. Chapter 39. One of the ungainly projecting arms of the space factory ended in a bulbous pod that housed a large industrial laser, a complex jumble of electrical power machinery and massive slabs of copper, polished so finely that a giant could use them as shaving mirrors. Dan Randolph hung weightlessly amid the thick cables and long rows of capacitor banks. The laser pod was unlighted except for the glow of the gleaming Earth revolving below, huge and bright and so close that Dan felt he could almost touch it with his outstretched hand. Silhouetted against the Earth's daylit blue was the bullseye structure of Nueva Venezuela, and hanging between them, looming larger every second, was the approaching Soviet space shuttle. It looked very much like any nation's shuttle, Dan thought, and for the totally pragmatic reason that they were all designed for the same task. Form follows function. And except for the red star painted on the shuttle's raked-back tail fin, the aerospace craft might have been built in Japan or India or California. Dan looked at the gleaming aluminum column next to him before reaching for one of the hand grips set into it. Signs that warned danger, high voltage, were stenciled everywhere, and he had no intention of frying himself before Moloch arrived. He half-climbed, half-swam in the weightlessness of zero gravity until he was hovering alongside a short, swarthy, pot-bellied technician in the olive-green coveralls of a laser operator. The man smelled faintly of oil and sweat and something acrid that Dan could not identify. "I imagine I must smell pretty much the same," Dan thought. The technician was bending intently over his control board, his short legs dangling in midair as he checked out the electrical circuitry. He grunted and nodded to himself as he clicked color-coded buttons across the length of the long panel. Holding onto one of the hand grips studding the edge of the control board, Dan nudged the technician. "Everything ready?" he asked. The tech looked up, and Dan saw that he had the butt of an unlit cigar clamped in his teeth.
"Sure. Ready to go. Checks out 100%.
Dan noticed a handful of fresh cigars in the tech's chest pocket.
"You don't smoke those things in here, do you?"
He broke into a ragged-toothed grin.
"Don't smoke 'em at all. Used to. Smoked a dozen a day years ago. But I made a bet with a guy. Whole case of Glenlivet. Ain't smoked one since then. Nobody says I can't chew 'em, though."
Dan was glad that his back was to the Earthlight, and the tech probably could not see the expression on his face too clearly. Then he turned slightly and pointed toward the approaching shuttle. "See the tail cone back at the end?"
"Sure. Where the rocket nozzles poke out."
"All right," said Dan. "I want you to make a cut just forward of those fairings that house the nozzles."
"I can saw them right off for you."
Dan tapped him on the shoulder. "Just a deep slice will do. Just enough to cut the electrical connections between the thrusters and the cockpit so they can't move the bird once she's docked with us."
"Gotcha. No sweat."
"How long will it take?"
"Couple of minutes."
"Fine. Wait until she's docked. I'll tell you when to start."
"Sure."
He reached across the control board, flipped open a protective covering, and clicked on the master power switch. From somewhere deep in the bowels of the machinery, Dan heard a generator begin to whine.
"That's all you want me to do?" the technician asked.
"That'll be plenty," said Dan.
"I could saw that bird into jigsaw pieces at this range, you know. Cut 'em up for good. They'd never know what hit 'em."
"And then one of their anti-missile lasers would do the same to us," Dan said. The tech grunted, as if he'd been hit in the solar plexus.
"No," Dan said. "I just want to cut off their retreat. The less bloodshed, the better."
"Except for one particular Russian," he added silently.
"You're the boss," said the technician.
The two men watched silently as the Russian shuttle maneuvered toward the factory's main airlock. The delta-winged craft rotated 90 degrees so that the hatch built into its top just aft of the flight deck locked onto the factory's airlock. To Dan and the laser operator, the shuttle appeared to be below them. It was as if they were floating a few hundred yards above it. The whine of the power generator was almost beyond the range of human hearing as Dan murmured to the technician, "Okay now, slice his balls off." The tech grunted once, took the wet, chewed cigar butt out of his mouth and jammed it into a pocket on the leg of his coveralls, then began tapping on the buttons of his control console as delicately as a church organist playing a Bach fugue. High overhead, Dan saw one of the big copper mirrors, thick and square as a coffin, swing silently in its jeweled mounting. He knew it was his imagination, but he thought he could feel the air inside this pod crackling as the mirror began to shimmer, like a desert landscape in the heat of the burning sun.